Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
What's happening in Hartford and how it affects you? Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly joins Melissa in the Morning now on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Kelly. Thanks for being here. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself, Melissa?
Doing just fine. Thank you so much. Earlier this week, Governor Lamont, was talking about nursing homes and the importance of making sure we take care of this most vulnerable population. I was reading, I think, on your website that nursing home death rates still 20 times higher than general public. What can you tell us about the announcement earlier this week from the governor and the data that you have?
Well, it's the same data, but, it all depends upon how you look at things. And we know that this is a very vulnerable population, and we need to exercise an abundance of caution, particularly when it comes to the COVID virus. And if you compare, infection rates to the general population, you come out with a different number than you do with the infection rate to those that are getting tested. And here, when you look at that, this is where you uncover, and I think comparing it to the general population, that's where you see the difference, that you have an infection rate that was 6 times higher and a death rate that was 20 times higher based on last week's information.
So I guess my question, Senator Kelly, is why push for making that differentiation? Why does it matter to have that information clearly stated? Like, listen, here's where the numbers are coming from, nursing home patients versus the general population.
Well, because residents in nursing homes paid a unbelievable price because of COVID. We know what happened back in 2020. We are armed with the Mathematica report that identified all the shortcomings when COVID first hit and what we needed to do to make sure that we protect this population. The fact that the Department of Public Health produces or releases infection rate information on a daily basis, death rates on a weekly basis, but as to nursing homes, does it on a biweekly basis, is just inappropriate. I mean, if it's good for the general public to release this information, it needs to be good for the most vulnerable population, because it's going to take 2 weeks to see trend lines. And this, group, I'm going to say 80% of all COVID-related deaths are individuals of 65 or over. This is where COVID is most lethal, and we need to make sure we're doing everything possible to protect them.
We're talking this morning to State Senator Kevin Kelly. The only thing, Senator Kelly, with all due respect, that I have to say, the COVID reports every day and every week to me are kind of slanted. With so many people doing the at-home testing, I feel like I honestly have not given a COVID report, the number breakdown. I don't think I've done that in over a month. And the reason is because I just don't find it accurate anymore. And that's not because of an opinion. That's just because of fact, that it's not like every time somebody has a positive at-home test, they're calling the governor's office or the Department of Public Health saying, hey, I tested positive. So that's my only question. I don't think you're wrong in what you're asking for, but I'm wondering if it really makes a difference, because it's truly not even really accurate information. Not saying the state of Connecticut's doing something wrong, but it's kind of impossible to even track those numbers accurately anymore, wouldn't you say?
Well, I agree with the tracking the infection rate, because you don't, the infection rate data doesn't capture it at-home testing. But what we still know are hospital admissions and deaths. And you can still track it through that, because if the death toll before Christmas and then versus after Christmas or week to week, you can still track and see the trend lines. And that, I think, is actually the most critical data number, because that tells you what the real impact is on human life. I mean, whether somebody's infected doesn't mean that it's going to be lethal. And still here you have a death rate that is substantially larger than the general population. So guided by that information, you see that, you know, we still need to exercise this abundance of caution in protecting this vulnerable population.
Fair. I do agree with that. I guess I'm even sketched out even by, like, the hospitalization rates, though, because it feels like that also has been sort of murky, where, you know, they're including people who contract COVID in the hospital, or they come in for something and it turns out that they had tested positive, so they count that as a hospitalization when, in fact, they didn't go in for that. I don't know. I've just been slowly but surely kind of, I don't want to say ignoring it, because I realize that's, like, the worst thing to say as a reporter, but I just don't feel like it's accurate in any facet anymore. I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
If you have absolutely, you know, you're putting your finger on an issue that, I mean, even when this was happening, you know, and I would deal with, and my end of the legal profession, I deal with probate. I'm speaking with funeral home directors all the time, and, you know, you would get a story about them telling me that there's, you know, the death toll in nursing homes is higher, but it's just not getting reported accurately. So you always hear issues around information. Is it really being captured accurately? And that's a healthy, actually, endeavor, is to question, you know, hey, is that right? Let's dig a little deeper. Let's try to find that out. But I still think, on the whole, you know, there are some trend lines that you do pick up. And I just think in this area, it's better to be a little bit more cautious, be a little bit more, ask more questions, because the population is so vulnerable. I think they deserve that extra scrutiny.
Yeah, and the other thing that I would agree with you on is, if we were to differentiate or point out the fact that this is an older demographic mostly making up the numbers, I think it would also put a lot of people at ease when you talk about eliminating mask mandates, for example. I think when you worry about, you know, who's contracting it, we know that kids can contract it, but that they're not really ending up in hospitals. They're certainly not the ones who are perishing. I think that could also be helpful to bring peace of mind to a lot of school districts that are in this predicament of, do we drop the mask mandate? Do we keep it? What do we do? What does the science say? You know, it's gotten kind of murky. So maybe that would help with bringing ease to the situation.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the death toll, obviously it hits, older individuals harder than younger. And also, the individuals in nursing homes normally have more of your complex and chronic issues. They'll have something underlying, whether it's a diminished capacity, it could be other issues, COPD. There's a number of issues that are diabetes. There's other issues that are also complicating that, in addition to COVID, make them particularly vulnerable.
I want to switch gears from talking about COVID to talking about something else that I think is at top of mind for a lot of people. State Senator Kevin Kelly is here this morning. For anyone who doesn't know the story, municipal school officials have alleged that former state rep Constantinos Diamantis, who had substantial control over how school construction grants were awarded and at what rate cities and towns were reimbursed, used threats to withhold state financing as leverage to press them to hire builders and other contractors of his choice. And now this morning, well, we've known this for a while, but Connecticut Senate Republicans are looking for both a state audit and a public hearing on the state's school construction financing program. Can you talk to us a little bit about this, Senator Kelly?
Sure. You see, whenever you have the FBI involved in a government transaction, it's not a good day. And we saw that the FBI got involved with alleged misconduct over COVID relief funds in West Haven. He called for public hearings then. Now you see, once again, school construction. There's alleged wrongdoing. And once again, we're back at it. Now, on Monday, we had asked for these and, wanted public hearings. We want more public oversight, transparency, openness. The governor then weighed in and said that he would be open to public hearings for his administration. So we then renewed the call. And so hopefully this time, given the green light by the governor, maybe we can get public hearings in the legislature to look at what's going on, so that, you know, the public who's watching this are starting to question, and, you know, they have a right. They make a sacrifice by sending their taxpayer dollar to Hartford, and that sacrifice needs to be respected.
I'm curious, Senator Kelly, and this is, I guess, more of an opinion question, but I'm wondering, especially because the governor seemed very open to the idea of public hearings around this, do you think he is open to this because of also at the same time we've got calls or accusations, rather, from Melissa McCaw in regards to two very important people who are part of his administration, both Paul Mounds and Josh Jabal? I have not heard a lot of movement on that, and they're pretty severe accusations, I think. And I know Josh Jabal has since stepped down to go take a job at Yale, but there are a lot of questions surrounding that, and I've seen that the governor is not really made any sort of movement on that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of information swirling around the Capitol in the recent days, and focusing on trying to just stay in your own lane, if you will. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there was the COVID relief funds. Then there's the school construction. Then there's others. I think we take it one day at a time, and we look at what's in front of us. And right now, looking at the school construction issue, there's a lot more there than we saw a couple weeks ago. More information continues to evolve. And so I think starting with the public hearings is the way to go there. As to the others, let's see what happens. Let's see what's out there and what the evidence brings. And then we'll see whether or not we call for the public hearings accordingly.
Do you think with overlooking or, I guess, checking more into the state school construction financing program, Senator Kelly, do you think that's going to impact current projects that are in the works? I don't know ones specifically that are impacted by this. Like, I immediately think of, one of the major high schools in Bridgeport that's been an undertaking for a while. But I don't know if that's connected to this program per se. Do you think there are any active projects happening in the state that would be impacted by this?
Well, I would certainly hope that the projects would continue. We would have to look at who is actually doing the work and make sure that whatever work is being done through code and that it's going to be a safe building. But you don't want to displace and hurt the children and the educational process, especially, when you look at school construction. These aren't things that you dream up in a month and start to act on. They're
right.
Usually years in the making. You finally get it to where it needs to be. You're probably deferring maintenance on the old building, and so you really need to get from where you were to where you need to be. And I wouldn't want to see that be displaced, but at the same time, I don't want to reward bad actors.
Right. Right.
So you got to be able to balance that and make sure that the taxpayer sacrifice, once again, is going to the purpose that it was meant to.
Senator Kevin Kelly, we have run out of time, but I appreciate you tackling these two big topics with us this morning, and we'll chat again next week.
You bet. Look forward to it.
Thank you. That's State Senator Kevin Kelly here on WICC. Yeah, we have been following these two cases very closely since January. It was, as I mentioned to you guys weeks ago, it was a good friend of mine, Frank Recchia of News 12 Connecticut, who broke the news initially of both the tragic and mysterious deaths of Lauren Smithfield and Brenda Lee Rawls. Both mysteriously died on the same day back in December, and we're now almost 2 months later, and still a lot of unanswered questions. I would argue more unanswered questions for the case of Brenda Lee Rawls, because we still don't even have autopsy results at this point. So joining me this morning, I have the incredible pleasure and honor having Angela and Deirdre on the show. They are Brenda Lee's sisters. Good morning, both of you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Angela, let me start with both of you can obviously feel free to speak up on this. First of all, can we just talk about who your sister was? Tell me about the person that she was.
My sister Brenda was a loving, kind person. She never had a bad thing to say about anyone. She kept a smile on her face all the time, and she just made you feel just good in any situation. She was a very kind person.
What do we know leading up to her tragically perishing? What do we know?
So first of all, I want to comment on what Rowena White, one of Mayor Ganim's associates. I just want to make sure that everyone know that my sister Brenda Lee Ross was not cremated, as Rowena White stated on your radio call with her earlier this month.
Well, I appreciate the correction. I know in speaking with you, Angela, the next day, I think I corrected it on the air that that was an understanding we had. And I appreciate knowing that. So your sister, we still just don't have autopsy results in. And if anything, it's worse that so she was not cremated, but we still don't have any indication of a cause of death at this point.
Not at this moment.
That's bizarre to me. If you don't mind me saying that, I find that to be really shady. I mean, have you guys hired like a private investigator or anybody to try and find those answers for you?
I can't comment on that right now.
Okay. Let's talk about, is there anything in regards to what led up to, we understand in both cases, you know, both your sister and it sounds like Lauren were both on dates with people. They were the last ones to see them. In your sister's case, did you know the man she was dating?
No, I did not. And I'd rather not talk about him because I really don't know anything of him.
Yeah, absolutely. How have things been since everything in December? I mean, I can only imagine my heart is just completely broken for your family and just dealing with a loss in general. I mean, is just heartbreaking. But how do you feel everything has been handled thus far?
Deirdre?
Well, no, I mean, I'm aware of it from the news point of view. I'm saying for people who have never, who maybe aren't familiar with the story or haven't heard from you directly.
Deirdre, you want to speak on that? Oh, she's not there.
Go ahead, sorry.
I just want to let Mayor Ganim, Chief Garcia, and the Bridgeport Police Department to know that my family were very, very upset and disappointed and disgusted and downright heartbroken by the way they treated my family when we went to them asking them questions about my sister. They're the people who are supposed to protect and serve us as citizens. We're not supposed to be out searching for them, looking for answers about what happened to our sister. They should have called us. As Rowena said, how would they get in contact with us if we don't have white pages anymore? We still have the internet. We still know how to Google. And I'm sure that the police department, they have more advanced equipment in their offices to help find the family of the deceased.
I agree. I agree with everything you just said, Angela. I'm curious, you know, the response a couple weeks after it became really national news, the response from the Ganim administration. What were, you know, did you feel that it was authentic? Did you feel like it was too little too late?
Mm-hmm. It was too little too late. They still haven't reached out to us. We still haven't heard anything. And for Rowena White to go on the radio station and make comments that no one from the Ganim administration ever reached out to us for us to give them that information, you know, it was just, I felt it was just disrespectful. Mm. And for her to compare what would happen to her if something happened to her, who they gonna contact, her dog? That was very insensitive for her to compare her dog to my sister Brenda Lee Ross, kin people.
Yeah, we're chatting this morning with both Angela and Deirdre. Deirdre, do we have you here? I just want to make sure.
Yes, you do.
Okay, just making sure because I know sometimes with the phones the connections are weird, but I'm glad to have you both here.
Yeah, the connection is weird. I can barely understand what you guys are saying.
Okay, well, I'm going to, you know what we're going to do is I have your number here. Christian, why don't we disconnect Deirdre and try calling her back, see if the connection's a little bit better. Let's try to call her back. So, Deirdre, we're going to call you right back. Let me see if we can get a better connection. In the meantime, Angela, you know, speaking about how the city has handled it. So let me confirm. So you have not heard from the Ganim administration since everything happened a couple weeks or almost a month ago where they, you know, put two officers on leave and call, you know, calling this a disappointment. You have not directly heard from the Ghanem administration?
No, I have not.
Wow. So from here, have you talked to police? Have they given you any update?
No, they have not.
No apology.
They apologized, but it didn't seem sincere.
Let's see. I think we have Deirdre back on the show. Deirdre, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Is that a little better?
Yes, much better.
Okay, great. Sorry about that. So,
that's okay.
Deirdre, anything in this conversation so far that you weren't able to comment on because the connection wasn't great? Anything thus far that I want to be able to hear from both of you?
No, I just want to say that we feel that the Bridgeport Police Department didn't do due diligence in my sister's case. They was irresponsible. And to me, her death is bad enough. And they added insult to injury by not contacting her family members. And I feel that there's no excuse to ask why they was not able to contact a family member. The Bridgeport Police Department, they had what they needed to contact a family member. They had Brenda's cell phone. So there is no excuse. My sisters texted and contacted Brenda every day. So all they had to do was look in her phone. Why did not they just look in her phone to avoid some of this that's going on? They had what they needed in the palm of their hand. My sister, like I said, text and talk every day. It is like it was said, it's either incompetent or just straight out racist. Even the more reason why we want and need the DOJ to come in and take over. They discarded her phone just like they did her body. They treated her like she didn't exist, like she didn't matter, like she was a Jane Doe, trash, garbage. Brenda was a beautiful, happy, loving, and caring human being. And it's like Councilwoman Small said, Brenda deserves to be treated with dignity and respect, dead or alive. My family is very disappointed. And the more I talk about it, the angrier I get. We're disappointed in the Bridgeport Police Department and in the city officials. Took them over a month, almost 2 months, just to speak out on this situation. Now the family has to suffer because of the way they handled Brenda's death. And I'm sure it's obvious to everybody that they dropped the ball. And instead of us being able to mourn the death of our sister, we had to try and figure out what happened to her. And it's sad, very sad, that we had to take on the duties of the Bridgeport Police Department when there are people in positions to take on that role. And everyone involved in this case, not just the police department, needs to be held accountable and brought to justice for the role they played in this unfortunate event. The family is tired. We just want justice. We want to move on. The family needs closure regarding this matter. Mayor Ghanem said he's there to answer every question we have. Where's the 911 tape? Simple answer, yes or no. Is there one? Is there a report, an incident report, dated the day Brenda died? Yes or no, simple question. Does Officer Jones exist, the one that was supposed to have been at the scene? Does he even exist? We can't find him. We haven't heard from him. Is he an officer, or is he a friend of the male acquaintance Brenda was with? Who called the coroners to come and take my sister's body away, not even giving us a chance to identify her body? Not even giving us a chance. We had no chance. Her autopsy was performed the day after her death. How quick that was. We, like I said, we didn't even have a chance to identify her. Who gave you permission to cut open my sister's body? I feel though Brenda's privacy was invaded. I feel though my privacy was invaded.
We are chatting this morning with Angela and Deirdre, who are the sisters of Brenda Lee Rawls, who tragically died back in December in Bridgeport. You've heard of Brenda's story and Lauren Smithfield's stories. And ladies, we are running out of time, but I guess the final thing I wanted to just comment on is, you know, I noticed that there's a rally tomorrow that's been organized by the Bridgeport Generation Votes Now. And my understanding is both you and Lauren's families were not consulted about it. Do you feel like this, you know, both your sister's story and Lauren's story have, you know, granted they've gotten a lot of national attention for good reason and it's calling for change. But do you also feel that, like, in this situation, it could be potentially being used without even your consent?
Well, we didn't get permission for them to use it.
So, right. So, yeah. Oh, sorry. Go for it.
Yeah, we wasn't invited and we wasn't notified. We wasn't given the opportunity to even speak at the rally.
Yeah, which just seems bizarre to me because I would think that your sister's story and Lauren's story are the biggest reasons that this rally is happening.
Yeah. Maybe they should have just given someone a call to enlighten us on the rally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I don't think we was even notified of it or, you know, offered to participate in it. We wasn't informed of it.
Mm-hmm. How long have you guys lived in Bridgeport?
I was born and raised in Bridgeport. I'm 62 years old.
So this whole situation, I would think, is even more disappointing because it probably feels like a department or a city that you've known your whole lives is not what it used to be. Or what you expected it to be?
You know, Melissa, I had pride just because I was born and raised in Bridgeport, born in Bridgeport Hospital. I was proud to tell people that. Now I can't, you know, say it with the pride that I once had because of the way the Bridgeport, Connecticut Police Department officials treated the death of my sister and the way they even treated us as a family.
Mm-hmm. Well, Angela and Deirdre, unfortunately, we have run out of time. I do appreciate you both being so open, so honest, sharing yours and your sister's story. And I have been praying on this situation that, like you had mentioned, Deirdre, that you can at least get answers and get truthful answers and get closure and be handled properly. And I do hope that happens incredibly soon because I can only imagine the pain that you guys are going through, and I'm so incredibly sorry about that.
Melissa, there's one more thing I would like to say, that we do have a GoFundMe out for Brenda if anybody would like to donate.
Sure. How do you what's like the website?
Tim, you know the website? I know it's on Facebook.
Melissa, they can just go to GoFundMe.com, Brenda Lee Ross, Justice for Brenda Lee Ross.
Okay. I will write that down. And what I'll do, ladies, is when I put this up on the podcast, I will put the website right underneath it as well. So if people want to access it, they can.
Thank you again, Melissa, for having us.
Thank you, Angela. Thank you, Deirdre. We really appreciate having you this morning. As you've heard from our Bill Jackman, there is a high wind warning for southern New Haven County until the end of this show. Wind advisory in effect until 10 as well for northern New Haven and all of Fairfield County. And one of the things we were most concerned about with this overnight storm was going to be power outages with the wind. And it wasn't really for our listening area so much as it was as you get into the southern part of New Haven County and then head up into the northern part of Connecticut. And we're starting to see those numbers kind of tick up as people are waking up and realizing they don't have power. The latest check this morning on Eversource's website is just over 13,000 outages, and on UI's website, just around 700 outages as well. And joining me this morning, he's always here, Mr. Reliable, Mitch Gross of Eversource. Good morning, Mitch. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Thanks again for having me.
Yeah, of course. I really do appreciate, Mitch, that whenever we have these big weather sagas going on that you come on the show. So I do appreciate your time. I know you're busy. So thank you.
My pleasure.
So tell us, you know, did you expect this? I mean, when I first got in this morning around 3 a.m., you guys were somewhere around 4,000. And I said, this is going to tick up just because people are sleeping and they're just realizing it. But is this about what you guys expected from this storm?
Well, you know, as I look at our outage map, the majority of those outages, those 13,000 you mentioned, are east of I-91. And that's what all of our forecasts and UConn's outage prediction modeling was telling us, that we would be pre-positioning the majority of our crews east of I-91 to take care of the outages. So far, you know, we're responding as needed. The crews have been out there overnight as needed. They're out there right now. And we've brought in hundreds of additional line and tree crews, as we do all the time, to supplement our crews. And, you know, as customers call with issues, we're responding as quickly and safely as we can.
You and I have talked about this before, that it's pretty common that you will have surrounding states have line crews come in. So that's what we did for this storm, was we had people come in from, like, Massachusetts, for example, to just be ready.
Oh, yes. That's standard operating procedure. We were looking at the potential for this storm Sunday, Monday of this week, and began reaching out for additional resources. They are here. They number in the hundreds. And again, that is now standard operating procedure. We reach out in advance as much as possible. We secure as many additional line and tree crews as possible. And, you know, everybody's ready to go to work when needed.
And we're talking to Mitch Gross this morning of Eversource. And if you're just tuning in, still just about 13,000 outages across the state of Connecticut this morning. I noticed that, granted, it's nowhere near the wind that we're seeing in northern Connecticut, but I have noticed that, like this morning at one point, Mitch, there was, you know, because I'm bored at 3:30 and I'm looking so deeply at the map. I think Oxford had something like 200 outages or something. And, you know, a couple minutes later, or boom, it was done. Are you finding that the majority of these outages, are these like individual homes, or is it where you've got an outage that spreads across a couple hundred customers at one time?
Well, Melissa, it's a combination of both. There are, as we call it, the singles, the ones and twos, and yes, some larger outages, like for instance in Woodstock right now. We have over 1,500 customers affected up in the Quiet Corner. So, you know, the crews are out there. They're working as the conditions permit. Keep in mind that if conditions become unsafe, if the winds get up to a point that the men and ladies up in the buckets think it's unsafe, they will lower the buckets and wait it out till the winds die down. And but they will stay on the job, and if you're affected, we'll get you back on as quick as we can.
That is a great reminder, Mitch, because you and I talked about this, I think, the last storm that you came on, that if the winds are too dangerous, that you might see the crews out and about, but maybe not up in the bucket. And that is because they've got to take care of themselves as well, correct? Like, if they have to make that call if it's too dangerous to be up in the buckets.
That's right. It's all about safety. They are extremely well-trained. They understand the situation, and again, it's all about safety. And if they feel that conditions are unsafe, unfortunately, they'll need to delay things until they believe it's safe to go back up and go to work. Keep in mind, you know, they work in all kinds of conditions. It takes a special person to be a line worker. It really does. They work in all kinds of conditions, all hours of the day and night, but they are a dedicated group and they're very good at what they do.
I mean, it's kind of hard unless you had a crystal ball that I don't know about, Mitch, but do you anticipate that these outages will be taken care of by the end of today? Like, what's the goal?
Well, we always, you know, prepare for the worst, hope for the best. We're as proactive as we can be in advance of the storm. And then once the storm hits and passes, we go into reactive mode. And again, I know I've mentioned this before when we've spoken, Melissa, all storms are different. And so we learn a little bit from each storm. We respond a little differently depending on the storm, but the goal is always the same, and it's to get you back on as quickly and safely as we possibly can.
Yeah, and probably not even a good idea to even say, well, we're hoping by the end of today, because you know somebody will hear that and go, well, they said, and we can't really guarantee that. But, of course, that's the hope. The hope is that everything is restored by the end of this storm today.
That's right. You know, it's we're going into a long weekend, a holiday weekend for some people. And, you know, we'd like to be able to enjoy the long holiday weekend with President's Day on Monday for some of us. So, you know, it's a dedicated group. You know, we all have a storm job at Eversource. When we go into storm duty, everybody goes to work, you know, accountants, attorneys, engineers. It doesn't matter who you are. You have a storm job, and it's part of our commitment. You know, we understand our customers expect the power to be on and stay on. So we're doing everything we can to make that happen.
And Mitch, if anybody needs to reach out to Eversource because they have an outage, I know you guys have like a texting line set up. What is your phone number if anybody wants to call Eversource?
If you are an Eversource customer and you have a power issue, the number is 800-286-2000. 800-286-2000. Keep in mind, you as an Eversource customer, you can also report your outage via our website, eversource.com. You can sign up for that two-way texting feature you mentioned, Melissa. The details are on the website as well. And of course, you know, we'll keep you up to date as to what's going on via our Facebook and Twitter social media channels. So we're out there, we're staying in touch, and we're staying on the job.
Mitch Gross of Eversource, I so appreciate that you give us the time on these stormy days. Thank you so much.
Anytime, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Mitch Gross of Eversource here on WICC.